Good evening, folks, and welcome back on this Saturday, the third day of July, Independence Day weekend, 2021. I'm your host, Mark Gall. I'm going to continue this week with a theme that I've touched on several times over the last few weeks since I got back out of a place I really never wanted to be. And that's basically, you are there. We're at the place that we've been warning about for so long. Meltdown, lawlessness, massive inflation, famine on the way, and all of that certainly means war is on the horizon. And it's true as well, and we've been talking about how to deal with this. We all have family, friends, neighbors that are utterly clueless. Many of them have taken the Zyklon B poke, with all that that implies. And just like most Americans won't realize what's actually happening until it's way too late, I've joked for years, not really, about the fact that they won't realize it until they walk into the Walmart and the shelves are empty. A lot of them by then, unfortunately, won't even be able to walk. So I've spent a lot of time on the theme that forewarned is forearmed. Most people won't wake up, so I spent a lot of time last week exploring the idea of discernment. There comes a time to realize that there are those who are blind and will not see. As the Bible says, in half a dozen different ways and places, they've rejected knowledge. They've chosen to believe the lie. They have itching ears, and so on and so on. So, as Yeshua put it, wipe the dust off your feet as they witness against them, and move on. Still, though, we are supposed to know the times and the seasons, and I suggest that at least part of the reason for that is that there are those who are in the process of waking up. They're certainly going to have some significant emotional events over the next couple of months, and so a lot of the information that we can hopefully provide to them along the way ought to be helpful. So with that in mind, let me start off with this today. Let's call it the potpourri approach as opposed to the fire hose. And when I put this one together, I decided I'd call it the Whopper ketchup sequence. I got the idea after I decided, and yeah, against my better judgment, to take a look at Snopes.com concerning a story that I recognized as a fraud when I first saw it. And of course, since it didn't fit their political agenda, they didn't even bother to put it up. But they did have a whole bunch of other crap, and I'm trying to be as polite as I can, that you might call clickbait on the front page. Like this one, did Chicago Mayor Lori Lightfoot refuse to give interviews to white journalists? A letter to the press drew fire from conservative media. Oh, and let's be clear here, folks. That kind of over-racism rightfully should draw fire from any honest journalist, especially in a place like Chicago. And the fact-checkers say, rating mostly false. What's true? Well, Lightfoot did send a letter to Chicago Press stating that on the two-year anniversary of her historic inauguration, she would only grant interviews to journalists of color to highlight the lack of diversity in the news media. How simply Clintonian of them. Gee, so what's false? It's not true that Lightfoot refused to do any more interviews, like you mean ever, with white journalists. But wait! There's more, because memes have been circulating lately, and you know how much the left hates those, especially since they're true and humorous. Well, one of them, a meme about the purported removal of country of origin labeling on meat, contained a mixture, they say, and that's as close as they seem to get, folks, to a real admission of true and false information. The claim, they claim, is that lawmakers slipped, and they put it in quotes, the repeal of the country of origin labeling for meat products into the December 2015 Omnibus Appropriations Bill. The rating, a mixture. Well, what's true, the fiscal year 2016 Omnibus Appropriations Bill did repeal existing regulations requiring meat to be labeled by country of origin. Full stop and good grief. Well, how the hell do you get off claiming that it's not completely true? Well, listen to this. What's false? It's not true, and nobody said this, you blithering idiots. It's not true that all meat is now unlabeled, or that the bill prevents country of origin labeling. They never said it did, you lying sacks of, well, I can't say it, but you know where I'm headed. This is the kind of crap, folks, that ought to have people saying, hey, is there any such thing as an honest fact checker on the left? Well, it hasn't been banned anyway by two Facebook and Twitter. Thank goodness, folks, that Matt Taibbi and Glenn Greenwald are still out there doing actual journalism. But back at least a bit more to our Snopefest, let me ask these blithering idiots a simple question. Let's ponder two options. An honest American meat packing company who proudly labels all of their meat as being real meat. Who knows, maybe it's even organic, born bred, raised, and harvested in America. Are they likely to remove that label? I don't think so. How about a disreputable charlatan trying to sell crap and get you to eat it? Now, it's just possible, although I'm sure Snopes would never consider this option, that such lying leftists might decide, maybe it's better if we don't tell the peons exactly where this stuff came from. Next item. Is it true that Tucker Carlson called a top U.S. military general a pig? Yes, it is! And guess what, folks? Mark Milley is a pig. And arguably a traitor, too. And finally, Snopes has this. Because, you see, there are some conservatives, even conservatives of color, like Candace Owens, who are attempting to besmirch the memory of St. George Floyd. How dare she? So they claim she has wrongly interpreted George Floyd's death to the public by pointing out that he was a drug abuser and a criminal, and that just may have contributed to his early demise. So they were forced to set the record straight in a piece entitled Background Check, Investigating George Floyd's Criminal Record. This question often surfaces, they said, among people who want to rationalize police officers' actions when black men are killed in custody. And wow, ain't that amazing? They can read Candace Owens' mind. Here's what she actually said, and at least they quote this. No one thinks he should have died in his arrest, but what I find despicable to be is that everyone pretending this man lived a heroic lifestyle when he didn't. I refuse to accept the narrative, said Owens, that this person is a martyr, should be lifted up in the black community. He has a rap sheet that's long, that's dangerous. He is, she said, an example of a violent criminal his entire life, up until the very last moment. All of that and more, they claimed, is partly false. Oh, and I know they had to look really hard to find that little teeny part that they could claim was false. Why? Because they printed his rap sheet and his prison record. And guess what, folks? It's long. 9 separate arrests that he was charged and convicted for. And that from Texas alone, going back to the late 90s, ranging from drugs to trespass to theft to aggravated assault and robbery with a deadly weapon. But let's talk about his childhood, says Snopes, and see if we can't even downplay that, well, admittedly most serious charge, aggravated robbery with a deadly weapon. Also, we can mislead people into believing what, folks? That Candace Owens' brilliant video entitled, I Do Not Support George Floyd, and Here's Why, viewed at least 6 million times, is somehow partly false. And yeah, folks, they conclude by saying it's even an exaggeration of toxicology reports to claim that Floyd was high on meth during his final moments on Earth, rather than that that just merely contributed to his early ascension to his reward. And listen to this bit of crap, folks. They ask sanctimoniously, why do some people draw attention to the criminal histories of non-white people killed by police? Come to think of it, why are all white people vilified by the mainstream press and called domestic terrorists? There's a question they're not asking. But why do some people draw attention to the criminal histories of their non-white betters? As statues of real American heroes are torn down en masse and replaced by criminals and communists? Gee, I don't know. Maybe the answer lies in their being sanctified by the media and used as an excuse for rioting, looting, and arson, among other things. And furthermore, to do billions of dollars of damage and destroy a lot of people's livelihoods. I wouldn't trust these scumbags to debunk a cute pussycat video on YouTube. From there, we go across the pond to a doctor from Britain's failed socialist medicine system called NHS, who exposes what he calls 6 impossible British COVID things before breakfast. And yeah, he's making a reference to one of your host's personal favorites, Lewis Carroll and Alice Through the Looking Glass, and the encounter with the Red Queen, who famously, and you know she'd make a great primetime CNN host, said, I've believed as many as 6 impossible things before breakfast. Well, former NHS Dr. Toby Young, via LockdownSkeptics.com, and of course Lou Rockwell, suggests that Brits are finally, maybe, getting more than a bit fed up with the COVID-1984 lockdowns. And he suggests half a dozen things going on over there that Alice herself probably still couldn't swallow. But it was his intro that I thought most deserved a space here in the Whopper ketchup sequence. I hope the readers he begins will forgive a little self-indulgence on my part if I relate an anecdote from the tail end of my 12 years as a junior doctor in the early years of the first Blair government. At the time, the health secretary, Alan Milbert, had issued strict waiting time targets to all hospitals. I, he said, was tasked with sorting out the numbers of patients on the surgical waiting list at a large teaching hospital. It became apparent that if I had a patient with a date for surgery, they no longer counted as waiting, even if that date was many months still in the future. Accordingly, I issued dozens of patients dates for surgery and achieved compliance with the waiting time targets at a stroke. There was just one problem. Both the managers and I knew that all those patients had virtually no chance of ever getting into the hospital on their designated dates. Due to a lack of available beds, they'd all be canceled just a couple of days before admission. So he said at a meeting with the CEO of the trust, I pointed this out. And the man looked me in the eye and said, "Let me make one thing clear to you. There is no problem with beds in this hospital." Briefly, he said, I considered debating the assertion, but I realized it was a pointless endeavor. The facts did not fit with the chief executive's preferred narrative, so it was the facts that had to change. He, by the way, was subsequently awarded a knighthood for services to health care. And here we are, some 20 years later, still believing six impossible things before breakfast. His things had to do with the usual hypocrisy and stupidity, and of course in Britain, lords who are still above the law. But this one certainly stood out. On Saturday, June 26th, he said, an enormous crowd marched from Hyde Park to Parliament Square with only the most cursory comment from the national broadcaster. And it was attributed to multiple protesting groups rather than what it was, anti-lockdown protesters. And if I hadn't been there, he said, I wouldn't have believed it myself. I'm not a demonstrator, said the doctor, but that crowd convinced me that if there is a route out of this crisis, it'll be by direct political action, because the vast majority of the people in that protest were normal folks, similar to myself, and their frustration and rage at the deceptions and propaganda practiced by our so-called elected representatives and salaried state servants was palpable. I'm already looking forward to the next one. Next, from Dr. Ron Paul about the HMS Defender versus the Russian military and the danger of believing your own bogus propaganda. Less than 2 weeks, he begins, after NATO members reaffirmed allegiance to Article 5, that an attack on one member was an attack on all of them, the UK nearly put that pledge to the test. In a shockingly provocative move, he writes, the UK's HMS Defender purposely sailed into Crimean territorial waters on its way to Georgia. Yeah, I know, says the good doctor, as Bojo later claimed. The UK, along with the US, doesn't recognize Russian sovereignty over Crimea, even though Crimea voted back in 2014 in a referendum to rejoin Russia. So they claimed they weren't violating Russian territorial waters, and this, he wrote, was an in-your-face move toward Russia just weeks after the US and NATO were forced to back down from a major clash with Russia in the eastern Ukraine. But this time, Russia took a dimmer view of the situation. Coast Guard vessels ordered the HMS Defender to exit Russian territorial waters, and they punctuated that order with rare live fire of cannon and the dropping of bombs. So, having had their bluff called, the UK government did what all governments do best. They lied. The Russians did not shoot at the UK warship, they claimed. It was a previously scheduled Russian military exercise in the area. But oops, there was a BBC reporter on board. What, didn't he get the memo? Who spilled the beans? Yes, he said the Russian military did issue several warnings. Yes, it did buzz the HMS Defender multiple times. And yes, there had been shots fired in the Defender's direction. And this isn't the first time, says Dr. Paul. Back in the spring, Russia rapidly deployed 75,000 troops on the border with Ukraine in response to a U.S.-backed Ukrainian military buildup. So the message remains clear. Russia will no longer sit by as the U.S. government and its allies intervene next door. And they have now demonstrated they'll protect Crimea. And let me add one observation here too, folks. The U.S. is now a communist Chinese puppet state, and Vladimir Putin and Russia know it. Especially after Putin had a chance to look into those senile, vacant eyes and recognize that not only did America no longer have a commander-in-chief, they were a whole bunch of sandwiches short of a picnic. Problem with the UK, the US, and their NATO allies, concludes Dr. Paul, is that they seem to believe their own propaganda, and they act like it. A famous 2004 quote attributed to W. Bush advisor Karl Rove spelled out this line of thinking, saying, quote, "We're an empire now, and when we act, we create our own reality." But these two recent near clashes with Russia demonstrate that the reality, says Dr. Paul, created by an almost religious belief in empire and NATO exceptionalism, can often crash hard against the reality of 75,000 troops or the Russian Black Sea Fleet. The problem is the anti-Russia propaganda endlessly spewed by both political parties in the swamp and amplified by the anti-Trump media for more than 4 years has completely saturated not just the Beltway but beyond. So even as the Russiagate conspiracy has proven to be a lie, the propaganda it spawned lives on. Blustering Bojo almost provoked a major war over an infantile desire to continue poking and prodding Russia in its own backyard. This time, war was averted. But what about next time? Will the adults ever be back in charge? I guess it's probably a bit redundant to suggest that the guy who participated in the biggest, most disgusting anti-constitutional fraud in the history of these formerly free United States might be a bit duplicitous. After he got away with that, he put his hand on a Bible and lied before a God that he wouldn't even mention on the National Day of Prayer. Why are we surprised? And he obviously truly detests the Second Amendment, because it's pretty clear by now that it's all once free Americans have left. Anyway, a while back I spent some time analyzing one of the biggest series of whoppers that he or any other liar who ever infected the Oval Orifice ever managed to get out in a short space of time, where he essentially said, "Shall not be infringed doesn't apply to slaves, and that means we can infringe it all we want, and that's a whole lot." Oh, sorry, he doesn't know the word infringe. He said, "We'll impinge it to non-existence."
And I might add, the Second Amendment from the day it was passed limited the type of people who could own a gun and what type of weapon you could own. You couldn't buy a cannon.
So many stinking lies. Still, though, that one did manage to roll a few eyes.
You couldn't buy a cannon.
I pointed out the day after that Thomas Jefferson certainly did. There were lots of others. But Robert E. Wright at the American Institute for Economic Research, courtesy of LouRockwell.com, went a whole lot further and outlined just how big of a whopper the prevaricator-in-chief committed at that point. And as he pointed out, this kind of ignorance just don't cut it. And his disembowelment of the executive disinfomaganda was pretty darn educational, not to mention fun. I want to spend a minute or two on it. He cites the sources and then goes on to note that, yeah, if you just bother to read a book once in a while, you would find that once free private individuals in a formerly free land could and did, number one, form their own military units, usually termed legions, that included artillery. Number two, organize and charter private militia units as nonprofit corporations. He notes that a number of people, citing a few, incorporated private artillery companies. Number three, you could own your own cannon individually and as part of mercantile partnerships for use on ships and protection against pirates and for use as privateers. Private ships licensed by the U.S. federal government under that Constitution thing you hate so much. And there are historical examples galore. To, among other things, seize or sink enemy ships. American privateers did it over 1,000 times, he notes, against the British in the War of 1812. Back when we were a free country, there were a number of companies that would develop, manufacture, stockpile, and sell cannons to meet the demand of private individuals as well as the government. Oh, and let's not forget, some of us can even remember this, that there were a number of organizations, from the historic to the fraternal, that used to own and fire their own cannons for celebratory purposes. We had one at my fraternity in the courtyard when I was in college. Fired it every time we had a major formal event at the house. And anybody that's ever seen The Music Man, or the Wells Fargo Wagon, knew that Biden was lying if they simply recalled this tune.
I hope I get my raisins from Fresno.
The D.A.R. have sent a cannon for the courthouse square.
And you know what? I can't help but recall that back when we were a free country, Americans wouldn't have put up with any kind of a cretin lying to their faces and making war on their God-given rights that their brothers and cousins and uncles and probably fathers had died to protect not too long ago from the Oval Office. Let's never forget our history.
Although the Wells Fargo wagon is a-rolling down the salmon from Seattle last September.
And I expect a new rocking chair. I hope I get my raisins from Fresno.
The D.A.R. have sent a cannon for the courthouse square.
So let's tie all the whoppers together today and put a great big bow on it with a piece from James Howard Kunstler entitled Falsehood Rules, where he begins by saying he expected, like many of us, that we'd be living through a period of confusion and disorder, but he just didn't know exactly what it was going to feel like. A nauseating existential disorientation, he said, kind of like being seasick on dry land. Like living in a 1920s German expressionist horror movie, we know what that led to. Like being held a prisoner inside Frank Kafka's castle. An immersion in totalizing falsehood. And it's the collapse of authority that's especially striking and disturbing. Ground zero, though, is the U.S. Department of Just Us, which got sickening traction after the election of 2016 when FBI Director and Whoremeister Extraordinaire James Comey and his underlings, along with a whole lot of high officials still at its parent agency, the DOJ, undertook a campaign to disable and expel the winner of that election, starting even before his inauguration. Russia, Russia, Russia was an epitome of falsehood, concocted in bad faith. The actions taken have never been adjudicated. The Mueller insult to public intelligence was devised to distract and cover up all the previous seditious bad faith of Comey and company.
These aren't the droids you're looking for.
Impeachment number one, remember, was supposedly about a phone call the president made to his Ukrainian counterpart, Mr. Zelensky, regarding suspicious activity on the part of one Hunter Biden, who got a whole lot of money from a gas company there, despite his total lack of experience, but the presence of connections with, oh yeah, you now at least know who. The big guy. Turns out there was a lot more going on there than nasty nutcase Nancy and Chucky Schumer ever wanted you to know, including a laptop that was lied about just before the election. But it turns out that the crooked FBI has had in its possession since before the first impeachment was even written up. And don't forget the COVID-1984 fraud, which led to the outright theft of an election via mail-in votes and outright electronic rigging. There's a forensic audit in Maricopa County, Arizona. Looks like it may blow the lid off what's happened. Other states even are poised to follow. So what would you expect? Oh yeah, in steps utterly crooked so-called Attorney General Merrick Garland, along with a host of henchmen in pursuit of an obviously, strictly political operation. They're trying to put the kibosh on any actual transparency and consolidate the successful Bolshevik Revolution. Ponder all of that, says James Howard Kunstler, while you make plans to celebrate Independence Day and a holiday that commemorates an earlier time when the people of this land had had enough of being played by tyrants. And rest assured, we'll talk more about that in the second segment, because it dawned on me as I was putting this show together that this weekend coming up is the 4th of July. Actually, better put, it's Independence Day weekend, where some of us still remember why a bunch of very good people in the Continental Congress in Philadelphia in 1776 pledged their lives, their fortunes, and their sacred honors for principles that will get you called a white supremacist and a domestic terrorist by the Biden regime today. This weekend at picnics and local gatherings and the like, I'll no doubt spend some time talking to people about exactly what it was that the founders wrote in that most important document, I contend, ever written originally in the English language. I've certainly done a number of lengthy shows over the years going into very specific detail about it. I'll probably at least reprise some of that this year as well on one of the shows I do here for these networks. But as I was thinking about all of that in the context of what's happened to formerly free America this year, and looking back over some of the things that I've done in years past, I came across this segment, which I recorded back in 2019, as an introductory, a companion piece to the Declaration itself. And I realized that the very fact it's so dated today makes it really interesting to take another look at. The contrast, at the very least, is certainly stunning. And what I'm going to do in the second segment is play it. I'm also going to go through it, and in just a few places, I'll make a couple edits. They'll probably be obvious. And hopefully, you'll see what I mean. When it comes to things like whoppers and indications that, yeah, if their lips are moving, they're lying, and worse still, if they want to poke you with a needle, they intend to kill you, this is a really good way, I think, of letting people know, again, just how far we've come and what's been done to once free America. And most importantly, why we need to turn around and go the other way. So stay with us. We'll be right back after the break. Welcome back to a special edition of the show for this week. I'm your host, Mark Hoff, and much of this was recorded back on July the 4th of 2019, with some additions and updates made this July 4th weekend, 2021. And as you hopefully know, it would be better known as Independence Day weekend.
The day on which the Declaration of Independence was signed by those founders who pledged their lives, their fortunes, and their sacred honors to a set of principles embodied in a document that has not only been largely forgotten, especially by the so-called educational system, but is in fact outright despised by far too many who sadly call themselves Americans. I'm going to say something controversial right up front today, folks. I believe if you do not hold those self-evident truths without which unanimously agreed there would be no United States of America, and that furthermore are the literal foundation upon which all subsequent law in this country, and by that I mean real law as opposed to the pretend kind, is based, you're not a real American. Oh, gee. Yes, he really said it. Because it's true, folks. And historically, it was not only true, but understood, up until the time when the law became not worth the parchment it was printed on, as George Bush famously pointed out. So I struggled a bit, this year particularly, with how to begin this discussion about what's really important concerning this day and the Declaration of Independence. In years past, I've concentrated on urging people to read it, study it, and understand it. And while that's still true and very important, there's a whole different level of outright animosity that I'm sure most of you have probably observed that puts this day now in a very different light. Case in point, the sentiment expressed in a July 4th piece by Dr. Paul Craig Roberts, former Assistant Treasury Secretary, entitled Liberty Has Lost Its Protection. And he summarizes it in the subheading by noting that July 4th now should be a day of mourning, because the rights our ancestors fought, and of course at least once famously pledged their lives, their fortunes, and their sacred honors for, have been taken away. And he begins by talking about how over the course of his lifetime, which is true for most of us, there's been a fundamental shift in the attitude of the judiciary toward constitutional rights. Because basically there was a time when they would guard against any diminishing of constitutional rights, and that was more important even than getting a conviction. Now, they don't give a flying you-know-what about constitutional rights, period. Honestly, to the point where the very worst abuses outlined in those grievances by the colonists against the evil, despotic, tyrannical King George III of Great Britain are practically trivial in comparison. King George had general warrants. New York City has stop and frisk. While TSA has searching and groping at airports, the likes of which the Redcoats wouldn't have even dreamed of, much less dared to commit. And let's not kid ourselves, if the evil King George III had had Google and two Facebook, we'd probably still be subjects of the British Crown today. And note that they still don't have free speech over there. Dr. Roberts points to examples of usurpations against the rule of law dating back years at this point. The war on crime, the war on, well, at least some drugs, the war on, well, at least some child abuse, the war on, well, at least some terror. All have destroyed the U.S. Constitution by what he called the death of a thousand cuts. And let's not forget selective enforcement. And if all of that fails, folks, you can simply bring in hundreds of thousands or millions of people who couldn't care less about the rule of law. Witness the fact that they're willing to break it by coming in. Why? Because basically the lure is a whole bunch of free stuff, all of which is totally anathema to the principles that we once held to be self-evident to begin with. Dr. Roberts concludes that the America romanticized by the various 4th of July fireworks celebrations no longer exists. And at least on that score, he's clearly correct. The Rutherford Institute's primary freedom and liberty author and advocate, John W. Whitehead, wrote along the same line, saying, indeed, it's painfully fitting that mere days before the nation prepared to celebrate its freedoms on the anniversary of the Declaration of Independence, the City Council of Charlottesville, Virginia, home of Thomas Jefferson, author of the Declaration, voted to do away with a holiday in honor of his birthday, because Jefferson, like many of his contemporaries, owned slaves. And all of this in their total ignorance of what the man actually wrote, stood for, and fought for. Maybe, however, they're even less without excuse than the University of Virginia, founded by Thomas Jefferson, which is not only equally ignorant and perhaps even more politically correct, but actually commits the crime of dumbing down the students, sick, who now go there, mistakenly believing they were going to get an education. Says Whitehead, this is what we've been reduced to, bureaucrats dithering over meaningless trivialities while the government goose-steps all over our freedoms and the nation is destroyed, by the way, from within and from without. Too often, he continues, we pay lip service to those freedoms, yet they didn't come about by happenstance. They were won through sheer determination, suffering, and sacrifice by thousands of patriotic Americans who believed not only in the cause of freedom, but also had the intestinal fortitude to act on that belief. The success of the American Revolution for Independence, he notes, owes much to these men and women. And this is an interesting quote. See if you can follow the logic here. In standing up to the British Empire and speaking out against an oppressive regime, they exemplified courage in the face of what seemed like an overwhelming foe. At that point, probably the most powerful army the world had ever seen. Indeed, he says, imagine living in a country where armed soldiers crash through doors to arrest and imprison citizens for merely criticizing government officials.
Oops. Well, in 2021, we don't have to imagine it. It's here.
Imagine that in this very same country, you're watched, listened to, monitored all the time. And if you even look a little bit suspicious, the police stop and frisk you or pull you over to search you on the off chance you're doing something, anything, illegal. And keep in mind that if you have a firearm of any kind or something that even looks like a firearm, it may get you arrested or in some cases shot by police. And he says, if you're thinking this sounds like America today, you wouldn't be far wrong. But that is, in fact, the way the scenario that took place well over 200 years ago was described, when American colonists suffered under Great Britain's version of an early police state. And it was only when the colonists finally got fed up with being silenced, censored, searched, frisked, threatened, and arrested that they finally revolted against the tyrant's fetters. And, of course, no document better states those grievances than the Declaration of Independence, drafted by Thomas Jefferson. The 56 men who 243 years ago laid it all on the line in support of that document believed in a radical idea that people are created to be free. And labeled traitors, they were charged with treason, a crime punishable by death. For some, their acts of rebellion would cost them their homes and their fortunes. For others, it would be the ultimate price, their lives. And yet, these men dared to speak up when silence was intolerable. Imagine, though, the shock and the outrage those same 56 men would feel today were they to discover that the government they once risked their lives to create has been transformed into a militaristic police state in which even exercising one's freedoms, the things they ensconced in the Bill of Rights, or even in some cases just questioning a government agent, is not only viewed as a flagrant act of defiance, but criminalized. He suggests that we need to renew that determination and remember what the Declaration says. That the point of government is to secure the God-given rights of its people, and that whenever any form of government becomes destructive of these ends, it is the right of the people to alter or abolish it. That, in other words, we could use some of that revolutionary outrage today. As for your host, I want to make one other additional observation at this point. It seems that the left coast is shocked, shocked, I tell you, at least Hollywood is, that the president would actually bring tanks to Washington, D.C. to celebrate
certainly not liberty or God-given rights. And it all sounds a bit quaint, doesn't it, in 2021, when it's not military prowess that anybody cares about, but LGBTQ pride. Yeah, they're upset over the wrong thing. Anybody still remember Nike from that year?
They got no problem kowtowing to the communist Chinese, but they hate anything that even smells like an American symbol, especially, I guess, the Betsy Ross flag showing the 13 original colonies that became those first 13 states. But all of that seems to make the point, folks. None of the argument here is about the fact that the United States has completely turned its back on the principles that once formed the basis for everything else that made America what it is. They claim to be anti-fascist while advocating for it. They claim to be anti-slavery while instituting it on more levels and in more ways than most dumbed-down Americans even have a clue about. And they're really upset about tanks in Washington, D.C. They ought to be upset because the tanks aren't on the border defending the United States from the invasion coming up from the south. Or at least on the Nevada border facing California. which kind of takes me full circle to the place that I started today. Should this day mark a celebration for what we once knew and had while we knew it? Or should it mark a day of mourning for what we've deliberately allowed to fall into not just disrepair, but disrepute? I can't help but think back to Ben Franklin's response to the woman who asked him outside the Constitutional Convention, "What form of government have you given us, Dr. Franklin?" To which he replied, "A republic, madam, if you can keep it." And I guarantee you, folks, most Americans today wouldn't even know what form of government they were once supposed to have. And no, it was never a democracy. And anybody who's ever read any of those documents will know you don't find that word in any form in any of the original documents, from the Declaration of Independence to the Constitution or the Bill of Rights. Because as they pointed out in many of their other writings, democracy, they knew, would result in precisely the kind of tyranny they were seeking to guard against reoccurring on these shores. Which brings me to one more really important observation having to do with law and the founding of a nation that's pretty well been deep-sixed at this point, both by enemies from within and from without. Especially if you remember that democracy is a form of government where 51% can completely steal and destroy the life, liberty, and property of the other 49%, and have, and will, by majority vote. Want to take somebody's stuff? Just outvote them. Want to steal their children? Well, once you take away their firearms. Want to kill them? Just outvote them. The Electoral College was just one of many impediments put in the Constitution to defend against the evils of democracy. Like two senators from each state, it was all about protecting the rights of the smaller, less populous states against the big and now obviously socialist ones that would otherwise run roughshod over them and certainly intend to. Witness what we're seeing with this direct democracy popular vote initiative signed by a whole bunch of really big socialist states.
And yeah, since I recorded this, witness what happened to the whole concept of honest elections and all those constitutional safeguards, including the Electoral College.
One by one, folks, we're seeing all the barriers that the founders wisely put in place to prevent democracies, which Madison noted have short lives and violent deaths, from infesting America. And let's not forget that if invasion from within doesn't work fast enough, there's always invasion from without. Why not open the borders, offer people all kinds of wonderful incentives to come on in and destroy the form of government we've had, which they didn't even know about or care about anyway, and replace it with mob rule? There's a reason, folks, why the continuing and massive invasion from the South is such a huge, divisive, and yes, downright deadly issue. First, economically and philosophically, and then, of course, inevitably, physically. Which leads me to do a bit of compare and contrast on this particular day. You can call it a logical argument if you want, or even philosophical, because the founders fought a war of independence for less than we're seeing on a number of fronts today. From those usurpations we've talked about, to the outright invasion. I can remember former President George W. Bush using this line more than once, saying, "We're taking the fight to the terrorists abroad so that we don't have to face them here at home." And gee, folks, some of us once thought that's what borders were about. Come to think of it, it's why we lock our doors. Knowing, of course, that the really, really bad guys will just pick the locks or bust the door down completely. And we're seeing that at large now. And that's, of course, why free people still understand the value of defensive weaponry. But it occurred to me that as a pilot, I have kind of a special reaction to all of this. I've shared certain aspects of it before, but I think in the context of dealing with immigration, especially the illegal and terrorist-filled kind, it's important to take a look at that again today. Most of you regular listeners know that I'm a private pilot. I've been a private pilot literally for decades, and I've owned a Cessna 182, a.k.a. a Skylane, for almost as long. And one of the things that I've had the joyful privilege of doing is flying that airplane just about all over North America, from way up north in Canada to way out east in the Bahamas, and several times down to Costa Rica, and lots of wonderful places in between. One of my favorite vacation destinations, and I guess this dates me, was the Baja, back before what's happened since happened. The entire peninsula was dotted with literally scores of airports, many of them associated with hotels that liked to cater to private pilots as a result. Many others were in small little towns where the locals understood the value of touristas dropping in to visit, enjoy a meal, or spend the night. And there were a whole lot of airstrips literally right on the beach where you could drop in to go snorkeling or fishing or windsurfing.
But long before even 9/11, I noticed things beginning to change radically. And I wasn't alone in noticing that. Almost every pilot who ever flew from California or Arizona through customs and down to the Baja had the same observations. Somebody or something seemed to be working hard to try to destroy the businesses, the industry, the ability of private pilots to fly down south. And over time, not only were the vast majority of those airports shut down, many of them were even ditched. And in some cases, it was done by the USDEA in a foreign country over the objections of the owners. Well, you may be thinking, and this, of course, is precisely what the propagandists want us to all think, it's all about drugs, and people were using those airstrips to bring drugs into the United States. Never mind that it really wasn't that efficient, especially in smaller planes that couldn't carry nearly as much as, say, a tractor-trailer rig or a whole bunch of cars streaming across the border, or even teams of coyotes. And just maybe, by now you're seeing where I'm headed, but after making a vacation trip to the Baja every year or two for well over a decade, it was my first trip to Central America that really opened my eyes. And yeah, folks, that was definitely a major adventure. I planned it out for months in advance, got information. In those days, before the internet, you had to deal with foreign consulates to get entry permissions and visas in advance to some countries, like Honduras and Belize. By the same token, there were some countries like El Salvador and Nicaragua that I was reluctant to fly over, so we went offshore. But still, it was a wonderful and exciting trip, and I learned a whole lot. Now, as a scuba diver, one of the things that I really wanted to do was dive the world's second largest barrier reef off the shore of Belize. There's also a big tourist attraction in those islands in that vicinity called the Blue Hole. And we arranged in advance a several-day excursion aboard a liveaboard dive boat. And it turned out on just about every front to be one of the best dive trips I've ever made. But the flying part of the story goes like this. The owner of the dive shop said, hey, look, it's a 6-hour trip across some pretty rough ocean out to the place where we're going to be doing all the diving, but there is a private airstrip out there on one of those islands that's got a nice little resort on it. Normally it's hard to get permission, but we've arranged that for you, and you're welcome to fly out and meet the boat there. It'll save you some time besides. And I thought, that's a great idea, and of course, as a private pilot, I love landing at new, interesting places. And that gave all of us a good chance to see the barrier reef from the air, too, so it was a win-win all the way around. So when we got out to that nice paved strip on the beautiful tropical island, I set up to land, and as I was literally on short final, I thought, hey, what is that on the runway? It was a whole bunch of orange 55-gallon drums, or barrels. So I aborted the landing, went around, and then immediately noticed all kinds of people running like little ants onto the field and rolling those barrels off. So we came back around and landed, and the manager of the resort came out to meet us right as we shut down the engines and apologized, which resulted in a really interesting discussion. The USDEA, he told me, and I thought, what? The USDEA in Belize? Well over 1,000 miles from the nearest U.S. border or possession? Yeah, that DEA keeps trying to shut down our airstrip, he says, and that would basically destroy our business. So at least for now, they're going to let us keep our airstrip as long as we leave 55-gallon barrels all over it, except when we're notified in advance that somebody's coming in to land. And again, he said, sorry about today. That way, evidently, if any pilot ever needed it in the case of an emergency, it would destroy the airplane. The bottom line all of us agreed then and now was that this was an incredible overreach, way out of U.S. jurisdiction, and it really did seem to have more to do with shutting down general aviation than it did with stopping drug trafficking. Especially when you think about it, if that same government is more than willing to leave the U.S. borders wide open. And in later trips to Costa Rica, folks, I saw example after example after example. And eventually it got to the point where I often talked with government and airport officials, often in Spanish with those that didn't speak English. Occasionally I asked some pretty pointed questions and got some pretty interesting answers. But one phrase that I heard over and over again was, Es su gobierno, señor. In other words, it's your government that's making us do these things we don't want to do. And in lots and lots of cases, it was literally cutting their economic throats. To the point where, the last time I was in Costa Rica, that's been a number of years ago, at a coastal airport called Liberia in Guanacaste, my single-engine Cessna was the only plane on the ramp that wasn't a corporate biz jet. And yes, Big Brother has now made it so hard and so dangerous, I don't want to go back, and I haven't. And one more really important aviation-related observation before I get to the coup de grace. Several times en route south, I flew over the Yucatan Peninsula. There's a really neat airport at an archaeological site you may have heard of called Chichen Itza en route. That used to be a really interesting place to land to go see the museum and Aztec pyramids and so forth. And from there south towards Belize and the Caribbean, you're flying over some of the most incredible and dense jungle on planet Earth. My father, who used to ferry airplanes all over the world for a living, starting before I was born, once told me that of all the places he's ever flown and didn't want to have an engine failure, a jungle like that was far and away at the top of the list, because basically, without a place to land, your plane would never even get through the canopy of trees to the ground. But thankfully, at least once upon a time, that wasn't an issue for pilots that wanted to fly safely to Central and South America, because there was a beautiful, wide, four-lane highway, the Pan-American, that you could follow all the way down, knowing full well that if there ever was a problem, plenty of places to land, right below you, anywhere. Well, that is, before Big Brother decided, we want to preclude that option. And if it kills a few folks, hey, no problem. Because somebody's tax dollars at work evidently paid for a whole bunch of poles to be set up along that entire beautiful strip of emergency runway so that it would destroy any airplane that even thought about trying to land there. But evidently, the same folks don't want to allow any money to be spent to build a wall. And throughout this entire set of stories, folks, what I'm trying to demonstrate to you is why so many pilots, having seen firsthand the hypocrisy of, uh-oh, we're going to shut you down, we're going to shut down all the businesses that thrive and survive doing things related to aviation and people being able to have the freedom of flight, even over international borders, all the while, on the other hand, lying through their teeth about how we've got to stop drug trafficking at any cost, and it's all about safety, unless, of course, we're talking about pilots and maybe kids that would be in the planes with them. We don't care if they die. We want to encourage mothers to drag their children through rivers or across barren deserts and see if they die that way. So literally, folks, for decades, I've seen the talk out of both sides of your mouth BS coming from people that tell us we've got to stop drug trafficking and all kinds of bad things entering the border, well, at least by air, but we could care less if people bring disease, drugs, and sex slaves across by land. Is there a disconnect here somewhere? But the final straw for me was a bit of Big Brother intimidation called EAPIS, the Electronic Advanced Pilot Information System, which went online about the time I made my last voluntary trip out of the formerly free United States by private airplane. Now, folks, over the years, I've seen the border crossing procedures get more and more and more bureaucratic, downright tyrannical, and, of course, expensive. That is, if you play by the rules and don't try to enter what you thought was your own country illegally. What really was the final straw about EAPIS, however, was that for the first time in American history, pilots actually had to ask in advance for permission to leave the country. And if that sounds a bit like Nazi Germany or the Iron Curtain, we're probably on the same page. And yes, there are no shortage of pilots with lots of really interesting and downright terrifying stories about the police state on that score. And as many of you probably know or at least suspect, if you cross the border by air without permission in advance, there's at least a fair chance, or so they'll tell you, that you might very well get shot down. So I guess if you're going to enter en masse, bringing disease, drugs, weapons that free Americans are no longer allowed to possess, and of course sex slaves too, clearly there's one major option. Come across by the tens or hundreds of thousands via the unprotected entire southern U.S. border. And not only will they not take your plane apart on the ramp, fine you all kinds of bucks, they'll give you free stuff and bus tickets too. Or maybe air travel, so that you can spread whatever it is you just brought in all over the country. And that, folks, in a nutshell, is why so many pilots, including your host, are more than disgusted with the incredible, not just hypocrisy, but stupidity of protecting the border against people that we don't need protection from, while inviting and literally subsidizing hundreds of thousands or millions of potential terrorists to come on in mass. And we'll pay you to boot.
And now, a couple of years later, we realize just how insidious all of this deliberate destruction has been. The founders' indictment of their tyrant still ring true. But in 2021, with bioweapons and total surveillance on top of it, just look how far we have, well, sunk.
Please think about that on this 4th of July, as some of us at least remember what it was that Americans, real Americans, as opposed to
those that now sit in Congress or steal elections and pretend to be president,
pledged their lives, their fortunes, and their sacred honor to build.
You can't teach what you don't know, but it's past time that we started. And may Yahuwah bless you and yours.